Okay, I want you to think for a moment with me, if you went back 500 years, 1,000 years, let's say 2,000 years, you actually go back and you bring someone who's living 2,000 years ago to present day, and they followed you around for a day, what would you have to do all day long?
Tell them about new things.
Tell them about new things, okay? So I'm counting on this. Ray, you have your phone in your hand? Or right nearby? Okay, because you use it for your Bible. Ray, if they saw you with that phone, they're going to want to know what it is, right? What would you say? Pretend I am from 2,000 years ago. What would you say to me?
Sit down.
It'll take a while. And you can't say, this is a cell phone. You know, like telephones, you can't do that, can you? Okay. I mean, what would you say to me?
It's a device.
What's a device?
It's a machine.
What's a machine?
Yeah.
It's hard, isn't it, Joe? Okay, it's a writing instrument. Okay, a writing tablet. It is, okay. Can you imagine explaining to them that you can actually talk to someone 100 miles away with that little square object? And that you can send them messages, you can listen to music or whatever. I mean, just all day long, you know, getting in a car and explaining a car. And you sit down at a computer and you bring up a news site and they're like, what's Congress? And you'd have to explain that. And all these kinds of things. It would just be constant work to give them an understanding of the world in which they're living in. Well, if that would happen, if you go back 2,000 years and bring someone forward, it also happens when you go back 2,000 years. When we go back 2,000 years, and we look at people and times and events that long ago, we're going to have some questions. We're going to have some context, some background, some information, some explanation to understand what's going on. And that is certainly so with the New Testament. Documents penned about 2,000 years ago, describing events about 2,000 years ago, and people who lived about 2,000 years ago, there is some, you know, pretty substantial lifting we must do. Well, this is what we're going to be doing on Wednesday nights for about 3 months here. We're going to be looking at the world of the New Testament, looking at the history that's the backdrop to the New Testament, looking at the culture, the societies, the way of life, the political situation, the religious situation, etc. Now, if you've studied the New Testament some, you've picked up some of this. You've learned some of this background. You can't help but to do it as you immerse yourself in the New Testament. But there is also a place for an actual effort in doing that, in filling in the gaps. And that's what we plan to do. We're reading the four Gospels this year and epistles that connect to those four Gospels. And immediately in the Gospels, we see a context very different than ours today, 2,000 years ago. So I want you to look at this with me. Just several things here. I just want you to get a sample of this. First of all, I'm going to have people read these. Lori, could you read Luke 2, 1, and then when I have you do it, 3, 1 to 2. Joe, can I get you to read Luke 4, 14 to 15? Ray, Matthew 2, 1 to 2. And then we'll proceed from there. So let's start with Luke chapter 2, verse 1. This was in the reading already this week. Go ahead.
In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered.
In verse 2.
Oh, I'm so sorry. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria.
All right, I didn't tell you to do that, but sorry, that's not on there. Then flip over to chapter 3 and look at those first two verses. Read those. Luke 3, verse 1 and 2.
In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Iturea, and Trachonitis and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene.
So we go back 2,000 years, and our questions are, who's Herod? Who's Pilate? And by the way, what's a tetrarch? These are not things in our world. This is a stretch for us. Who are these people, and why are they listed? They must have some relevance here. And then there's Luke chapter 4, verse 14 and 15, Joe.
And Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee, and there went out a fame of him throughout all the region round about. And he taught in their synagogues, being glorified of all.
All right, thank you. Actually, we read this passage on Sunday, and I want you to see two things. First of all, going backwards, there's this expression, synagogue. What is a synagogue? Now, you may be thinking, well, I know that in Jewish communities and with Jewish population, there are synagogues today. Is that the same thing? Good question. Yes and no. And then, if you're used to the Old Testament and you're coming to the New Testament, a synagogue is a brand new thing. There are no synagogues in the Old Testament. Why is that? Something has happened between Old and New Testament to bring about synagogues. When you read the New Testament, Jewish people are constantly in synagogues. Jesus was regularly in the synagogue. Paul was constantly in the synagogue. That's not in the Old Testament. What happened to bring this about? And also Galilee, that's not a common reference point in the Old Testament. And then there's Matthew chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, which is Matthew's account of the birth of Jesus. Matthew 2, 1 and 2, right?
Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him."
So again, going from Old to New Testament, Judea is an interesting expression because you see the designation Judah in the Old Testament. But now Judea, which is sort of the same thing and sort of not the same thing as Judah. And then you have this reference to Herod, who is a king, who has a keen interest in this Jesus that's been born as the Messiah, the Christ. And as you read the next several verses, you see that he wants to kill this Jesus. So who is this man? And why is he doing this and acting this way? Now, look at a couple more here. Matthew chapter 5. Rachel, can you read Matthew 5, 20? And then, Becca, can you have Matthew 5, verse 22 and 20, chapter 22 and verse 23 ready? So, okay, Matthew 5, verse 20. This is Jesus talking.
"For I say to you, if your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven."
Pharisee, that's not an Old Testament expression. And it's not one that we use today. The term scribe, you sort of can figure out what that is. Somebody is doing something with writing. But Jesus says, this is like a benchmark, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you can't enter the kingdom. So that is an important distinction. You need to know who the Pharisees are to do that. And then there's another group that keeps popping up in the Gospels. Okay, Becca, read that one, Matthew 22, verse 23.
"The same day the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him and asked him."
So another group called the Sadducees. Again, can't find them in the Old Testament. They've come about since the close of the Old Testament. And we don't have Sadducees today. So who are these people? Well, they're going to be instrumental in the death of Jesus. So it's important to know something about who they are. Now look at Matthew chapter 27. Neil, can you read that for us, verse 26? This is at the after the sentencing of Jesus here by Pilate, the governor of the Roman governor. And just read verse 26 of Matthew 27.
"Then released he unto them Barabbas, but Jesus he scourged and delivered to be crucified."
You know, the New Testament never explains what crucify means. And to the first century reader, when you read this, if you got a hold of this gospel, and it said they led him to be crucified, to crucify him, you knew exactly what it meant. And you may pick that up today culturally, because of religious things, but there's nothing in our culture that's similar to that, parallel to that at all. It's a unique expression that in the New Testament, the text of the New Testament assumes you know what it is, which means 2,000 years later, we have to do some work to know what that is. And then I want you to look over here in the epistles, and these are epistles that we'll be reading later on in conjunction with the Gospels. Look at Romans chapter 1, verse 16. Zachary, can you read that? Romans 1, 16, and unless I have you read Galatians 3, 27 and 28 afterwards. So what does Romans 1, 6 say here? This is Paul writing to Roman Christians.
For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek.
It's a very common verse, and it's often quoted, but I want you to stop and think about it. The gospel is the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes. That should be it. And then he says, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Why does Paul have to make a distinction? Or rather, why does he make a distinction? Jew and Greek. And then look at this distinction, Galatians 3, 27 and 28, about those who had been saved.
For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus.
Look at those distinctions. Paul is having to labor to say, those distinctions don't matter. Jew, Greek, and then he says, slave or free. Speaking of that, look over in Ephesians chapter 6 rather. Unless while you're there, you're not far from it in Galatians. In Ephesians chapter 6, read verse 5 and then down to verse 9.
Okay. 6, 5 through 9.
5 and 9, just separately.
Okay. Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart as to Christ. And you, masters, do the same things to them, giving up threatening. Know that your own master also is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him.
All right, thank you. Now, Herod and Pharisees and crucify, those are all strange things to our day and culture. But this one, you're talking about a different world altogether. Slaves or bondservants in the flesh and having masters in the flesh, and masters having slaves. And this is a regular reference in the New Testament. Slaves and masters. What was that relationship like? Is that just like what happened in America, a century and a half ago when there were slaves, like in North Carolina and other places? Was it just like that? Yes and no. I would say to you probably more no than yes. And we'll talk about that later. So here's the point. A greater understanding of the context of the New Testament is going to result in a greater understanding of the writings of the New Testament. We have to do a little work to fill in the gaps, to create the backdrop to understand what's happening. And we have plenty of tools to help us do that. I'd say a lot of us know a lot of this, but to put it together systematically and have it there setting so that when we read Luke and we read Hebrews and we read Romans that we can place it on that, it really helps to enhance the meaning of those texts. Matter of fact, for someone who's not studied the Bible, and they pick it up and they start reading, these are the kinds of things they really stumble over. What's a Pharisee? Who's this Herod guy? He's really mad at this Christ being born. And they had slaves and masters? That really turns me off, and that's really troubling. It is troubling. And how do I understand what's going on there? And so it's easy to take these things for granted when you swim in them all the time. But these are things that practically can really calls people to struggle with understanding the biblical text. And so that's why we're going to take some time here next several Wednesday nights and focus on that. So I want to give you a preview of where we're headed in this and where we'll be focusing our time. Actually, today, hopefully I'll get through this. If not, I'll get through most of it and finish next week the rest of it. We're going to do a really quick timeline of events and developments. This happened, then this happened, this happened. These people emerged. This people faded. This big thing happened that affected a lot of people eventually in the New Testament. And so we're going to be looking at that timeline here later on today. I want you to look at this statement at the crucifixion. This is John's account of the crucifixion in John chapter 19. And it makes a reference to the sentencing of Jesus. And it says in John chapter 19 and in verse 19 and 20, Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. That's one of the keys. That's a little subtle key that we can pick up and say, okay, if that inscription over Jesus' crucified body, which is the centerpiece action of the New Testament, and yes, even the whole Bible. And John takes the time to describe that placard above Jesus and how it was written in three different languages. That's a key to insert and turn to unlock a lot of things. Now, I mentioned this Aramaic the other day. Who commonly spoke Aramaic? We talked about this just a couple weeks ago or less. The Jews. Jews living in Palestine. And by the way, Palestine is what we can call that area of Israel now, because that's what the Romans called it. And the New Testament is a Roman world, as we'll get to. The Jews living in Palestine, their native tongue, their everyday tongue, was the Aramaic. However, most of them also spoke Greek. You just couldn't get along in this world without speaking Greek. And so it is the most common language. It is to the Mediterranean world what English is today in a big part of the world. You can go all over the world and speak English and talk to people. There are other languages, if you speak it, once you get outside that native land, it's hard to find people that can speak that language. And who spoke Latin? The Romans. That was the language of the Romans. Now, where was Jesus crucified? What city? Jerusalem. Jerusalem is in the hill country of Judea. It's up in the hills. We know what that's like. You have to make an effort to get to it. It's not near the coast. It's not near a big river. It was not, on paper, you wouldn't think it to be a cosmopolitan kind of city. The reality is, Jerusalem was fairly diverse. It's mostly Jewish people. But even in that city, there were a lot of non-Jews. And that tells us a lot. The Jews, the Greeks, and the Romans. That's the key to understanding the New Testament world. And I would have you look at it like this. And this is what we're going to spend a lot of time on in this class, looking at individually these things and then the relationship of these three. And that's Jewish society, and I use that term society very generally. That would involve the relationship the Jews have with each other primarily and how they're established there socially, but also their way of life, okay, and even their culture, obviously. And then there's Greek culture. There is no greater characteristic of a culture than language. Language is the number one marker of a culture. And the fact that so many people spoke Greek meant so many people had been affected by Greek culture. just like people all over the world. They've read Mark Twain. They wear blue jeans. They drink Coca-Cola and they listen to rock and roll. Well, now it might be rap, but you get the idea. They know what those things are. There are more people who've heard of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln around the world than who've heard of the political leaders of Argentina through time or Canada. That's just how it is. Greek culture had been so dominant. We'll look at the story of how that came to be. And then Roman rule. There are a lot of things about Roman society and Roman culture, but where the Romans put their mark most of all in history and where they put it in the New Testament era is in Roman rule. It's their government structure. It's their military. It's everything about their rule. They are in charge. They're the boss in an earthly way. They thought they were bosses in every way. But it's the Roman rule, and it's the conflict between these three spheres. Jewish society and Greek culture, Jewish society and the Roman rule, and even to some extent the Greeks and the Romans. And not just the tension and the conflict between the Greeks and the Jews and the Romans, but sometimes it's important to understand the conflict within Jewish society. Thus, Pharisees, Sadducees. And the conflicts even within Greek culture and Roman rule. There's sometimes, you know, when it comes to ruling, there's always politics. When it comes to politics, there's always interplay. There's always competition. There's always one-upmanship. And that's happening in the New Testament. It has a lot to do with how Jesus was executed. Pilate didn't want to get in trouble with the higher-ups. And so even that tension within the Romans plays into the New Testament world. But it's not just how these three, you could say, three worlds make one. The three worlds make the New Testament world. And it's not just how they collide and how they rub against one another, but it's also how they are interconnected. The Romans had adopted so much of the Greek culture. The Romans honored the Greeks. Romans were fascinated with the Greeks. And you can't quite understand the Romans in the first century unless you have the Greek background, because the Greeks greatly affected the Romans. And then the relationship between the Jews and the Romans and the Jews and the Greeks. This is one of the critical questions from the close of the Old Testament through the New Testament. How are the Jews going to interact with the Greeks and the Romans? Are they going to be friends? Are they going to be enemies? Are they going to be frenemies? What are they going to be? And that tension there and that struggle and that tug of war is a big part of it. You see that in the Gospels. You see it in the book of Acts, and you see it in the letters. And so one of the first big problems in the early church was circumcision. We've talked about that recently in studying 2 Corinthians. And that was a tension point between those who had been converted out of Greek culture and those in the church who thought they ought to adopt Jewish culture to be in the kingdom of Christ, and that was not necessarily according to the gospel. So there was tension there. And so these all intersect, these collide, and they affect one another. And understanding that tension within Jewish society, within Greek culture and Roman rule, and the tensions they have with each other, that's a big stage for the New Testament. Now, besides those big picture kind of things, I want to get into some specific aspects of the New Testament world. Obviously, religion is going to be huge, not just in the Jewish society, but also what Greek culture said about religion and what the Romans practiced. We're going to talk about economics. You think, well, that's weird to talk about economics. How many parables have to do with economics? Can you name any? Parable of the Talents. The lost coin. Economic rule number one, don't lose your money. Okay, there you go. Lost coin. What else?
Pearl of great price.
Pardon?
You say the pearl of great price.
Pearl of great price. That's right. And the treasure found in the field. That's an economic impact to you. You went and bought the field because you knew there was treasure in it. There's just all kinds of economic activity. All the agrarian activity had an economic dimension to it. If you had a vineyard that was referenced in the New Testament, you're not just growing grapes for you. You're probably growing it to sell. And so economics are all through this. And think about Acts 19. The people of Ephesus are really upset with Paul and the other Christians. Was it merely because they had a different religious view? No, it was because they were teaching against the idolatry by which the craftsmen were making money on the temple there in Ephesus. So economic aspects and dimensions play into what's happening in the New Testament. Also marriage and family. Who's the first couple you're introduced to in the New Testament? And by the way, they're not married yet. Who are they? Okay, the very first one. That's right. The very first one. They are married, by the way. The very first one. You're right. Luke. Okay? You're right. Luke. Talks about that. Mary, Elizabeth and Zechariah, the priest. Who's the other Gospels introduce what first couple?
Joseph
and Mary. They're not married, right? What are they? They're betrothed. What is that? That's another cultural difference. We don't have betrothal now. Back then, if you broke a betrothal, it was a legal act. It's like getting a divorce. It's engagement with a binding contract. So it's a different kind of thing. And so there are a lot of aspects of marriage and family that's different now than back then. And to understand the biblical text, you got to understand that. Slavery. I want to spend a whole class on talking about slavery. And I think it has a relevance to us because it seems like that always, and it just keeps resurrecting, when slavery existed in America, there was a very intense debate in the 40 years leading up to the Civil War about what the Bible says about slavery. And there were those who said the Bible advocates slavery and those who said the Bible does not advocate slavery. Well, which is it? We first got to understand Bible slavery. And there are some similarities to what was practiced in America in earlier days, but there are some significant differences. So we're going to look at that because not only is slavery existing there at that time, but so many metaphors and illustrations about salvation relate to slavery. Like the term redemption. Redemption, used all through the New Testament, means to buy someone's freedom who's enslaved. So we have a lot of those allusions all through the New Testament. And cities. You're like, cities? Okay. Why would we talk about cities? All right. Fill in the blank. The letter to the Romans. The letter to the Ephesians. Letter to the... Okay, yeah, there. Who knows where they're at? They're different places. Letter to the... What? Thessalonians. I mean, there's just all kinds of cities. When Paul's on his missionary journey, he's going from city to city. Why is that? And what were those cities like? Well, I'll tell you this. You wouldn't want to live there. You bunch of soft, clean Americans with plenty of food and creature comforts, you would have not liked those first century cities. But the gospel flourished in them. So we'll talk about the cities aspect too. Even though we read Acts last year, we're focusing on the gospels and the letters, it still has a lot of relevance to it. Okay. All right. Any questions on that preview, where we're headed, what we're going to be focusing upon? All right, let's see how far we can get with this timeline. It's on the back there if you're using the sheets. So let's figure out where we're at in the world in time. So here we go. First of all, let's just real quickly reference what this is about, okay? These very common designations for time. We live in 2023 AD or CE. What is this about? Well, the traditional way of marking time in the Western world has been based upon the birth of Christ. The birth of Christ was approximately around 1 AD. Some evidence it may have been a little bit before that, maybe a year or two after that, but it's basically around 1 AD. And that's an abbreviation for a Latin term, Anno Domini, means year of our Lord. And so since the birth of Christ, the Western world, Europe, North America, and some other places, have counted time since the birth of Jesus. And then before Jesus, that just simply means BC, before Christ. In the last couple of decades, another designation has emerged you'll see in literature, so don't stumble over it. And that is CE, which stands for Common Era. And it's meant to de-Christianize, I guess you could say this. I don't think it's worth getting upset about. Okay? It's not that big of a deal. First of all, it's still marking it since the birth of Jesus. And so that's not changed. But even if people didn't mark time that way, that, you know, tons of Christians have lived and died and never marked time that way. The Apostle Paul lived and died and never marked time that way. That's not how he marked time. So that our Christianity doesn't depend on using AD and BC. But it does show the influence of Christianity. And so CE means common era, and then BC means before common era. And so more and more literature that you'll encounter will use CE and BC, but it's still marking the same periods of time. The New Testament era roughly covers the first century AD. So it's very common to say in first century, you know, times, just say that, use that expression. And that really covers the New Testament era. And if you take a late date of the book of Revelation, that means all the way up to the 90s. Just keep that in mind. Now, I know this timeline is not, the numbers aren't, you know, laid out equally there. We've got 300 years here, 400 there, and only 100 years there, but that's just to get all the information in. Understand what we're looking at there. Well, let's go back and look at what we recently have studied in the last year, and that is the Israelites of the Old Testament and the last things happening to the Israelites in the Old Testament. They had divided into the northern and southern kingdom, and Israel is carried off into captivity in 722 BC or BCE by the Assyrians. We studied about that recently. And what was notable, do you remember when they took the Israelites out of that area there, out of those tribal lands of Ephraim and Issachar and Zebulun and all that, what did they do with those Israelites? Do you remember? They take them somewhere and put them all together in one spot. What happened to them? They dispersed them everywhere, all over where the Syrians had holdings. And they had controlled the whole Mesopotamian area. And actually, the Assyrians conquered all the way down to Egypt. So they dispersed those Israelites everywhere, which basically gutted them of any kind of strength. They can't get together and organize and resist. And they put other people back into Israel. They left a few Israelites there, but they repopulated it with non-Israelites. It's a good while before Judah finally collapses. And of course, both Israel and Judah are being overrun by these foreign enemies because of what reason? Well, they're going to do that, and they're going to be led astray into idolatry. They're going to be immoral. They're going to disregard the law. They're going to disregard the prophets. And finally, Judah collapses. The Babylonians actually basically controlled Judah before this, but they're allowing local rule. It's 587 when they come in and just wipe out the city of Jerusalem and destroy the temple and carry off the King Zedekiah. So it's by 587 that you've got the Babylonians carrying the people of Judah into captivity. Now, what's different about that captivity as opposed to the Assyrian captivity and the people they take and what they do with them? Right. They all go into the Babylonian area and they sort of stay together. And they begin to develop this identity, though they were Israelites from different tribes, the vast majority of them, because some had migrated in, the vast majority of them are of Judah and some of Benjamin. Talked about that recently too. And that's why in captivity, they start being referred to as what? Jews. Now, go with me to the book of Daniel. Daniel is in captivity. He's one of the early captives taken. He is a young, talented man of the upper class. He is taken and he is used to be a liaison between the Jews and the Babylonian court. He is used to serve in the Babylonian court, and he is given a Babylonian, a Chaldean education. And he and his friends go through several trials of their faith and so forth, and they come through with flying colors, by the way. And one thing that happens is the mighty king Nebuchadnezzar that had toppled Jerusalem, he has a dream. And he's troubled by that dream, and nobody can explain the dream to him. And so finally Daniel comes, because God guides him with an interpretation of the dream. And he explains the dream. So look here in Daniel chapter 2. Ken, can you read that for us? Verse 31 to 34, first of all. And he describes the image that he sees.
You saw, O king, and beheld, and behold, a great image. This image, my image, and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, the chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and broke them into pieces.
Okay, an image, and what's unusual about this image? How is it constructed? Which is not typically how images are made, or statues.
It's different materials.
Different materials. The head is made out of what?
Gold.
Okay. And the chest and arms, what?
Silver.
And then the middle part and the thighs. And then the lower legs and the feet. Iron and clay. And what unusual thing happens to this image, the statue? It was broken apart by a rock. A rock. The most common thing, right? Of course, it's a mighty rock that does this and is cut from a mountain. So Daniel interprets this. Ken, keep reading. Read verse 37 to 40.
You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beast of the field, and the birds of heaven, making you rule over them, all of you. And you are the head of gold.
Let me stop you right there. This is a reference to whom? Daniel is talking to what great king?
Nebuchadnezzar,
the king of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon is the head of gold. That's what Daniel says. Keep reading, Ken.
Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth.
Let me stop you right there. Who was it that overran the Babylonians and allowed the Jews to go back, if they wanted to Judea?
The Medo-Persians.
Persians. Cyrus the Great. The Persians did. So if there's another mighty kingdom coming after Babylon, actually occupying some of the same lands, it's Persia. That's the kingdom of silver. And then there is another one after that, bronze. And if you're looking at this part of the world, the next mighty kingdom that rises is Alexander the Great's kingdom, who was Macedonian, but he ruled over the Greeks. All right, keep reading, Ken.
There shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these.
So the fourth one is coming after the Greek Empire. And it's not characterized by blitz, like gold and silver. It's characterized by what? strength, iron. Okay, that's what it's characterized by. Iron is the strongest metal at this point. They're not really working with steel much yet. But what's going to happen to when that rock comes out of the mountain and crushes the statue, where's it going to strike it at? The head? At the feet. At that fourth kingdom. So Daniel is previewing for us the history. Starting with the Babylonians, there will follow the Babylonians three kingdoms. And in the days of that fourth kingdom, that kingdom's going to be destroyed, so to speak. All right? What's going to do that? Ken, keep reading, verse 44 and 45.
And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure.
Thank you. There are three characteristics of this kingdom that comes and destroys the fourth kingdom. And that is, it's of God. And it's to last how long? Forever. And it is a kingdom that was not made by man's, no human hand. You could say in a way, God created all these kingdoms in a way. He brings them all up. But there's something special about this kingdom that's coming out of the mountain, the rock. It has nothing to do with human hands. It's totally God's making. But when you put all that together and you look at the other prophecies of the Old Testament, this is in reference to the Messiah and his kingdom. And in the days of that fourth kingdom will come the Messiah's kingdom. That's what's being communicated. And that's what we'll pick up right there next Wednesday and fill out the rest of the timeline and see how history unfolds and takes us to that time of the fourth kingdom that's going to be hit by that big rock.